Last week, and we've been in this series since the beginning of the year, and I won't recap the whole the whole book of Genesis, but last week we've been in the story of Joseph. And last week we began to see how Joseph is finally being vindicated for all the evil, for all the suffering that he has been put through by his brothers. The tide is finally turning in his life. And God is working out his plan of redemption in not only Joseph's life, but in the whole house of Israel. We saw Joseph get pulled out of the prison, and because of God's presence with him, he was able to interpret Pharaoh's two dreams. And not only do that, but he was able to offer this plan of wisdom. Hey, here's how we should proceed navigating this upcoming famine. And Pharaoh immediately gives him this job of not being sent back to prison, but of overseeing all of the kingdom of Egypt, overseeing his household, and overseeing this plan to save for these 7 years of plenty. And you can see it, and I know many of you already know the story, but if you don't know the story, you can see the inevitable confrontation that's set up between Joseph's family, who's going to have to come to Egypt for food, and Joseph, who is distributing the food. Today, the brothers are going to come to Egypt, and they're going to have to deal with their past. So let's read it in Genesis 42, starting in verse 1. Just 1 through 5. It says, "When Jacob learned that there was grain for sale in Egypt, he said to his sons, 'Why do you look at one another?' And he said, 'Behold, I have heard that there is grain for sale in Egypt. So go down and buy grain for us there, that we may live and not die.' And so 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. But Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with his brothers, for he feared that harm might happen to him. And thus the sons of Israel came to buy among the others who came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan." Now we learned very quickly that Pharaoh's dreams from last week have proven to be true, right? And Joseph's interpretation has proven to be true. This famine is not only affecting Egypt, but it's affecting the whole known world. For 7 years upcoming. Now, this is a death sentence in their day. For us, a famine is, man, I accidentally skipped a meal and I'm just starving. You would think my kids, you know, we treat them so horribly because we ate lunch at 12:30 instead of 12, right? This is not that. This is a big deal. If they don't have grain, if they don't have crops, if they don't have food to feed their animals, and they're going to die. Israel's family, his family is affected in the land of Canaan. So he hears through the grapevine, there's not food here, but I heard that if we go to Egypt, we can purchase grain. And so he sends. He sends how many of them? He sends 10. 10 of the brothers. There's 12 total, but he sends 10 of them on a week-long journey to Egypt. Supposed to take about a week to get there. Going to buy, going to come back in about a week, and they're all going to be saved. They're going to have bread. They're going to survive. Now, why only 10 brothers? Why does the story give us those details? Well, when there's originally 12, what we're seeing play out is their past. What we're seeing play out in the present is their past choices and their past mistakes. We're seeing Israel's jealousy and his favoritism playing out. And we're seeing the effects of the brothers' sin, them disposing of one of their brothers, right? Selling him, Joseph, into slavery. Israel refuses to send Benjamin, right? Because the last time that he sent Joseph on just a couple days' journey to go find his brothers, what happened? He never saw him again. He said, I'm not doing this. I'm not sending Benjamin on this week-long journey. He's got some PTSD, and he refuses to let something similar happen to Benjamin. Why? Because that now is his favorite son. You see the problem here? He's transferred what was his favorite from Joseph now to his favorite remaining son from his favorite wife, Benjamin, from Rachel. Do you see the complicated family dynamics here? And so the 10 brothers, they head to Egypt, probably with caravans of others, going to Canaan to purchase grain from Joseph. Look at verse 6. It says, "Now Joseph was governor over the land, He was the one who sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. That should ring a bell. And Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them. But he treated them like strangers and spoke roughly to them. "Where do you come from?" he said. And they said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." And Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. And Joseph remembered the dreams that he had dreamed of them. And he said to them, "You are spies. You have come to see the nakedness of the land." And they said to him, "No, my lord, your servants have come to buy food. We are all sons of one man. We are honest men. Your servants have never been spies." And he said to them, "No, it's the nakedness of the land that you have come to see." And they said, "We, your servants, are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is no more." That's a nice way to put it. But Joseph said to them, "It is as I said to you, you are spies. By this you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not go from this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you and let him bring your brother while you remain confined, that your words may be tested whether there is truth in you. Or else, by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies." And he put them all together in custody for 3 days. And we can see God's hand immediately in this story. As God ordains it, as God has worked all these evil things together for good, who is it that these brothers have to go buy grain from but Joseph? And when the brothers show up to purchase grain, what does it say that they did? They bowed down before none other than their brother Joseph himself. And Joseph immediately recognizes them. They don't recognize Joseph. Joseph's probably shaved, and he's probably got a totally different appearance, living in Egypt for 2 decades. They think he's dead. They think he's a servant or a slave, or he has passed away. But Joseph looks at them, and he sees them bowing down, and he remembers. He remembers 20 years ago. He remembers the dream that he had. Remember the dreams, right? What was the first one? It was all these sheaves of wheat bowing down to one sheaf of wheat that was taller. And it was interpreted to mean that this would be the brothers bowing down to Joseph, that he would rule over them. And as Joseph watches this play out in real time, it says that he remembered the dreams that God had given him. He's seen it play out. He's seen all these things come true. This is unbelievable, just that from a story perspective, right? That God has been working this story, and he has brought it to this point. We didn't see how it all was going to work out at the time. Joseph didn't understand. But then Joseph marvels at God, but then he kind of turns back to his flesh for a minute, right? Joseph immediately begins to ask them questions to seek more information. Now, he's not speaking to them in Hebrew, their dialect. He's speaking to them in whatever the Egyptian dialect was. And he begins, "Who are you? Where do you come from?" Right? 10 grown men, like this is a little suspect. And he begins to be harsh with them. He's suspicious of them. And he immediately accuses them of being spies. You've come in to see where we're vulnerable as a nation, and you're here to take advantage of us. Joseph knows this is not true, but he's got a moment here, a little bit of power. And I think in this moment, I don't know that he's necessarily wrong or right. I don't know, to be honest. I think we've probably been in similar stances with people. But he wants them to taste what he tasted for the last 20 years. He's got a little bit of revenge he wants to get. He's got a little bit of, "I want you to understand what I went through for the last 20 years. And so he is harsh with them. He has a plan to even imprison them, right? Now they immediately go, "No, we are not spies. We're honest men. far from the truth, right? They've been lying to their father for 20 years, right? We're honest men, all from the same man, all brothers. It'd be highly unlikely that 10 brothers would all be spies, right? This is their proof, right? We're not spies because we're all brothers. We're all from the same family. And they say we have this other brother who's back home, and then we have one who is no more, right? Right? They don't want to bring it up. They don't want to tell Joseph. They don't really want to be honest men, right, like as they've claimed. And I think when Joseph heard this, man, you just gotta put yourself there. I think his heart, I'm just no more to you. I'm the one that's just no more. Is that what you're telling people? And I think when he heard this, he realized his play. Oh, that's what you say? Then prove it. Prove it. You want to prove that you're not a spy? You want to prove that you're faithful, honest men? Then go home. Send one of your brothers. Go get your little brother and bring him here. And that way I'll know you're really telling me the truth, that you're trustworthy men. Now, he knew they wouldn't do this. He knew that the dad wasn't going to send Benjamin. He knew that Benjamin was his favorite now. And he's maybe hoping they might, but he has his doubts. He's hoping maybe I could see my father. Maybe I could see my brother after 20 years. And so what does he do? He puts all of them into a pit, into a prison for 3 days. This is a small taste of what they have put him through. But I think Joseph enjoyed those 3 days. I'm just going to say that. Text doesn't tell us that, but I think he enjoyed those 3 days watching the brothers squirm. And he tells them, you need to pick one brother. You need to send him back and prove that you're trustworthy men. Let's keep reading. Verse 18. It says, on the third day, Joseph said to them, do this and you will live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers remain confined where you are in custody, and let the rest go and carry grain for the famine of your households. And bring your youngest brother to me, so your words will be verified and you shall not die. And they did so. And they said to one another, in truth, we are guilty concerning our brother, and that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us and we did not listen. That is why this distress has come upon us. And Reuben answered them, did I not tell you not to sin against the boy, but you did not listen? So now there comes a reckoning for his blood. They didn't know that Joseph understood them, for there was an interpreter between them. Then he, Joseph, turned away from them and wept. And he returned to them and spoke to them, and he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. I think after 3 days, the shock and the anger that Joseph has gone through, it kind of simmers down, right? He gets a little space and things calm down in his heart. And he realizes, I don't really want my family to suffer. I don't want them to go through what I have gone through. And so he tells them, he gets the translator. He's still playing the game. He's not revealing who he is. And he tells them, here's what I'll do. I'll hold one of you. Instead of all of you and you send one, I'll hold one of you and all of you can go back. Take grain to your family, make sure that they survive, but one of you will stay until you bring Benjamin, your younger brother, to Egypt. He's not negotiating with them. He tells them, this is how it's going to be. And the brothers agree to it, right? But then Joseph gets to overhear this conversation. He overhears them discussing amongst themselves what to do. And it's interesting, where do they turn? Where do they turn when he begins to hear this? Where do they turn? They turn back to their guilty consciences. They turn back to things that happened 20 years ago. What they are feeling in this moment is a word we use called conviction. They feel conviction for what they have done wrong. That they, and maybe they felt this way for 20 years, maybe they've had these same conversations back in Canaan, but they feel conviction. They blame each other. They begin to turn on one another and blame one another for this terrible situation that they got themselves into. And we kind of get some details here that really paint a very vivid picture of what happened the day that they sold him into slavery. The story previous just kind of skips over this, but it tells us here that when Joseph's in the pit and they're about to sell him, that Joseph begged for his life. And those brothers who were supposed to love him and have compassion towards him and supposed to care for him, they listened to their little brother beg for his life, and they felt nothing. They did not listen to him. They hardened their hearts towards Joseph, and they watched him weep and cry, and they sold him anyways. And this paints such a vivid picture of the distress that Joseph went to. And now, 20 years later, they're sitting in a jail cell together going, the reason we feel this way, the reason this is happening today, is because of what we did to our brother. And the Reuben, the oldest, who's supposed to be in charge, supposed to be the one to make sure all of this goes well, he speaks up and he begins to point fingers. He blames the rest of them for all that they did. And he reminds them, I told you, don't hurt the boy. Don't do that to him. And Joseph hears that. And Joseph comes to the point where he overhears this conversation, and it tells us that he was broken and he began to weep. He had to leave the room. He had to go somewhere else and weep and let it out. He had to come back to continue to play this part. He overhears all of this, and he remembers the pit. He remembers the camel that they put him on. He remembers the details of being sold into slavery. He remembers the household he went to and how he was treated at first. And he remembers all the pain, all the heartache that has happened. He remembers the decades of struggle and trial because of that. But he doesn't just remember that. Now he hears his brothers. He hears the guilt that they feel for what they did to him. He hears his oldest brother, Reuben, say, I told you don't do that to him. And his heart wrenches and breaks. He has to walk out of the room. And in the walking out of that room, his heart is moved for them. He is softened towards them and to Reuben. And so he doesn't take Reuben, the oldest, and put him in prison. No, he takes the second one, Simeon, who was involved in this plot, and he puts him, and he sends Reuben and the other eight back. And here's what happens. Look at verse 25. It says, and Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain and to replace every man's money in his sack and to give them provisions for the journey. And this was done for them. Then they loaded their donkeys with their grain and departed. And as one of them opened his sack to give his donkey fodder at the lodging place, he saw his money in the mouth of the sack. And he said to his brothers, my money has been put back. Here it is in the mouth of my sack. At this, their hearts failed them. And they turned trembling to one another, saying, what is this that God has done to us? And so Joseph's heart is being softened to his brothers, right? So he doesn't just send them back and give them the grain, take their money and let it be. No, he gives instructions. No, fill their bags up and make sure they get their money back. They don't need to pay for this. Joseph is showing them grace even before they realize it. So they put the grain in, they put the money back in the bags. He gives them these extra gifts and food and stuff, provisions for the trip, right? Joseph is being generous. He's being compassionate to them, even though they don't see it yet. And as they go on this journey, one of them, it doesn't tell us who, it says that he opened his sack to give a little feed to the donkey, and he realizes his money is sitting on top. This may not seem like that big of a deal, but he knows immediately what this appears to be. The appearance of what this is that he stole from Joseph. He knows immediately that this appears to be really bad. It appears to be that he is a thief. And so he begins to explain, no, guys, somebody put it back. This wasn't me. I don't know where this money came from. I didn't steal. And it says that all of them realized this in this moment. their hearts failed them, and they turned trembling to one another. What is this that God has done to us? They are still feeling the conviction and the guilt, and now they've turned to God is getting us back for what we did to Joseph. They know they didn't do it, but they know that this appears that they stole. And what this means is we're probably not getting Simeon back. We can't go back to the king and him know that we think we stole from him. If he finds that out, man, this is not good. Nothing's going right in their life. And their conviction, their guilt is growing, and they don't have anywhere to take it. They don't have anywhere to put it. Look at verse 29. It says, when they came to Jacob, or Israel, their father, in the land of Canaan, they told him all that had happened to them, saying, the man, the Lord of the land, he spoke roughly to us and took us to be spies of the land. But we said to him, we are honest men. We've never been spies. We are 12 brothers, sons of our father. One is no more, and the youngest is this day with our father in the land of Canaan. Then the man, the Lord of the land, said to us, by this I shall know that you are honest men. Leave one of your brothers with me and take grain for the famine of your households and go your way. And bring your youngest brother back to me. Then I shall know that you are not spies, but honest men. And I will deliver your brother to you, and you shall trade in the land. And as they emptied their sacks, behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when they and their father saw their bundles of money, they were afraid. The brothers take the trip. It takes a few days, a week. But it's a few days later than anticipated. Their father probably had spent a couple days wondering where they were because this had taken longer. So they get back and they begin to explain to their father what has happened. This is the second time in the story the brothers have come back from afar and they've had to explain why one brother is missing. For the second time they return, and this time they don't conjure up a story, they just seek to tell the truth. Because they know the heartache and they know the pain that this has caused their father. They understand what he has gone through because of their lies. And so they tell him about this lord of the land, this Joseph, who was rough with them, accused them of being spies, and this whole thing that Simeon's being held in custody until we return back with Benjamin. And they begin to unload their sacks as proof, and they unload their sacks, and what do they find? What do they find? What does the father see them as they unload their sacks? He sees all of their money. And just like the one that was on the road that saw his money, all of them have their money in their sacks. Not just one, but all of them. And all of them now appear to be thieves, appear to be swindlers, appear not to be honest men, appear to be those who are out to get the Egyptians. And they all realize in this moment, this is bad. They understand the chances of us getting Simeon were pretty slim to begin with. Now, they're probably non-existent. And so they all look in disbelief and they wait to hear, what is Dad going to say? Look at verse 36. It says, and Jacob, their father, said to them, you have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more. And Simeon is no more. And now you would take Benjamin? All this has come against me. And then Reuben said to his father, kill my two sons if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my hands and I will bring him back to you. But he said, my son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead and he is the only one left. If harm should happen to him on the journey that you are to make, you would bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to Sheol. Israel is not pleased. I don't know if he has ever been pleased with this group of hoodlums. And as only a heartbroken father can do, he relays to them, you have bereaved me of my sons. Joseph is no more. And I don't know that he is blaming them necessarily. I don't think he understands what they have done in the past. I think there's still a shroud of secrecy over that. But he blames them, and he blames them for Simeon. Simeon is no more. He's not going on a rescue mission. He's not doing anything to try to get Simeon back, right? He blames them. Why do you think that if you cause me to lose Joseph and now Simeon, that I'm going to trust you with Benjamin? He's my favorite. He's the only son I have left. This is terrible, right? Well, why would I trust you? And now it looks like you've stolen all this grain. Like, you are not honest, trustworthy men. As if they needed to be told that. As if they didn't already feel the conviction and the guilt in their heart. Now, Reuben speaks up, and he really speaks pretty ignorantly. He offers, "Hey, Dad, send me. And if I don't come back, then you can kill my two sons." That dude's an idiot. What do you mean? Like, is that supposed to be, "Yeah, oh yeah, that sounds good. Yeah, if you don't come back, I'll kill your two sons." That's not what Israel wants to do. Israel doesn't want bloodshed. This is ignorant for Reuben to offer somebody else as collateral. This is ridiculous. And Israel says, "No way. Benjamin will not go to Egypt." And you can see his favoritism show through when he says, "I've lost Joseph, now he's the only one I have left." He's standing there looking at nine other brothers. Is that right? Yeah. Nine other brothers. He's going, "This is my only son I have left." Talking to the other brothers. They're just chopped liver, just standing in front of him, right? Israel is willing to keep Benjamin and give up Simeon, just ride him off. "No, I'm not trading him for him." He says, if I send Benjamin and he dies, I'm going to die too. I will die of heartbreak. This is a mess. This is an absolute mess that they have gotten themselves into because of jealousy, because of strife, because of anger, because of all sorts of sin. And now in this moment, right in the middle of their dysfunction and their mess, they're feeling conviction about this. They are feeling the guilt of their decisions, and they don't know where to go with it. Now, we're gonna pause right here in the middle of this story, and we'll pick back up next week. But I want us to think about the spot that they're in, this spot of conviction, this spot of feeling guilt over what we have done. See, the brothers are feeling deep guilt, deep conviction over what they had done to Joseph 20 years earlier. Now, granted, they don't have the Spirit of God living in them. They have a moral conscience that tells them between right and wrong. They have some understanding of God and his standard. But they knew without a doubt, "We are guilty men. We are not honest. We are not trustworthy. We are slanderers, we are liars, we are murderers." Their conviction and our conviction about sin is always meant to lead us towards God, not further away from him. Their conviction, they didn't know what to do with it besides try to cover it up, try to hide, try to massage it. See, conviction is always from God to bring us back to God. That's why God convicts us of sin. If we don't have the Spirit of God in us, and you've seen this play out maybe in your own life or friends' lives or coworkers' lives, when we don't have the Spirit of God and we feel conviction and we're told that we're wrong, it leads to defensiveness. "Well, you don't understand what I went through, and you don't, no, that's not really true because da 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 da." It leads to justification. "Well, actually, I'm right in this because they did X, Y, and Z," right? See, when we have conviction but we don't have the Spirit, it leads to us even blaming others. "Well, this is really their fault." This is a conversation I have with my kids every week, right? When I get on to you for what you're doing wrong, the correct response is not, "Well, but she did X, blah, blah, blah," right? Because that's what I hear more often than not. Well, she hit me first. Son, I'm not talking. I mean, not, it's daughter, I'm not talking to you about what they did. I'm talking about what you did. See, conviction, being feeling a sense of that it's right or wrong in our life, is meant to lead us back to God. And we are so prone to do this, to want to defend or to blame or to justify. See, but conviction is meant to lead us to honesty. These brothers are not being honest with their father about what has really gone on. They are not proclaiming the truth. And the truth that we're meant to learn from this is God doesn't restore what we don't acknowledge. See, James tells us that if we confess our sins one to another and to God, then he is what? He is just and faithful to forgive us of our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. See, the wonderful truth this morning for us as Christians, we're not Old Testament believers who don't understand Christ and his sacrifice and his death on the cross and forgiveness and all of that. The wonderful truth for us is that when we acknowledge our sin, when we confess it to God, when we confess it to one another where appropriate, he is faithful and he is just to what? To forgive us of our sin. This is the radical truth that we can bring our junk before the Father and own it and say we messed up. And the Father says, I will forgive you. Why? Because I put all of that on Jesus. He's already taken and paid the price for that. God has made a way for us to be forgiven. We have a place to take our conviction. We don't just have to sit and feel guilty. We don't just have to justify or blame or whatever. And the beautiful truth is you don't have to come through a priest. You don't have to come through a pastor and confess that to God. When Jesus died on the cross and the veil is torn, it's a picture that we have access to God as every believer, that you can speak directly with the Father. You can own your sin. You can take responsibility for what you have done. And God freely and abundantly gives forgiveness. Now we're stopping in this story right in the middle of this conviction, right in the middle of this mess. Simeon's in prison. Benjamin is not going to Egypt. And the whole family is full of fear and guilt. But what they don't understand is God is already working his plan of redemption in their life. He's working to bring healing and forgiveness and redemption. You see, God is present in the middle of our mess. And he loves us enough that he sent Jesus to die on the cross for us, that don't matter what we've done, if we will own it and acknowledge it and confess it, he forgives us. Let's pray. Father, forgive us where we have failed you and where we've fallen short and we've not been who we needed to be and not done what we needed to do. God, forgive us where we've blamed others or been defensive or justified our actions or just straight up ignored conviction. God, may we realize that when we are convicted of things that are wrong in our life, we're meant to draw near to you as Christians, that we're to come to you and bring our stuff to you, to confess it, to own it, and to receive the healing and the forgiveness that you want to give us because of what you did in Jesus. God, we thank you for this good news. Does it make sense? We don't deserve that. But we come together as a group of people who have experienced that forgiveness, and we thank you for the mercy and forgiveness, God. We love you. Thank you for your word. We pray all this in your Son's name.